In front of the Supreme Court, mourners and memorials pay tribute to the legacy of Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. But elsewhere in Washington, politicians are fighting hard over the next lifetime appointment, right in the middle of an election.
It's a really seismic moment in what already is a very turbulent and closely fought campaign.
We'll talk about where things stand and what to watch. Plus, after lots of back and forth between Washington and Beijing, two of the biggest names in American business get the backing they need to make a deal for TikTok. We'll explain the latest twist. It's Monday, September 21st. I'm Mark Stewart with The Wall Street Journal, and this is what's news. Before we jump into TikTok, there's major news about another Chinese-owned app, WeChat, which more than a billion people use for messaging and e-commerce. A U.S. federal judge temporarily blocked the Trump administration order curbing Americans' use of WeChat. The ruling cites free speech concerns. Now to TikTok. President Trump gave his support to a deal to allow Oracle and Walmart to partner with TikTok's Chinese owner, ByteDance. This would create a new U.S.-based company. We want to give you some perspective from our reporters on both sides of the Pacific. Here's tech reporter Lisa Lin.
Some people see it as a big win for China because this is the first time we've seen a Chinese company break out of the mold of just being simply a copycat of existing Western models and come up with something that's truly innovative, truly creative, and has gone global.
We asked White House reporter Alex Leary why the administration would agree to this.
It's a big departure from what President Trump initially laid out. I think there were a number of factors that he faced, including some political pressure of potentially turning off a wide number of users. ByteDance says that there are about 100 million U.S. users of TikTok. So it's a big group of people.
In addition, a planned U.S. ban on downloading TikTok is on hold while the deal is finalized. The death toll from COVID-19 now approaches 200,000 in the U.S., the world's highest. This comes as some medical experts warn of a new wave of American infections. COVID concerns meant last night's Emmy Awards were held virtually. The series Schitt's Creek dominated the comedy category. Here's co-creator and co-star Daniel Levy.
I just wanted to say, for any of you who have not registered to vote, please do so and then go out and vote, because that is the only way that we are going to have some love and acceptance out there.
HBO's Succession won Outstanding Drama Series. The founder of electric truck startup Nikola is stepping down. Trevor Milton's departure comes in the wake of allegations from a short seller that he and the company made false statements to investors, overstating the development of Nikola's technology, which says it makes electric trucks powered by batteries and hydrogen fuel cells. We've reported that U.S. investigators are looking into whether the company misled investors. Nikola has called a short seller's report false. On Twitter, Milton said he will defend himself against what he calls false allegations. He said in a company statement that he had asked the board to step down, so the focus was on the business, not him. Nikola has not yet sold any trucks. With all the talk lately about hot tech stocks, you might be surprised by what the best-performing S&P 500 sector is this quarter. It's materials. Our markets columnist Mike Bird explains.
That's everything varied from crop nutrient producers to mining companies, and they're basically all recovering on the back of the bounce in raw materials prices. Everything from corn to soybeans to copper, and essentially that bounce back is predicated on expectations of a somewhat faster economic recovery than was expected at the beginning of the quarter. It's slightly different from tech in the sense a lot of tech companies might be benefiting from people going increasingly online. These are benefiting instead from the expectation that things reopen a little bit quicker than they thought. You probably won't have heard of as many of the companies, but they are doing very well at the moment on the back of those economic recovery expectations.
Just ahead, as Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg's contributions are remembered, politicians fight over the future of the Supreme Court. We'll look at this high-stakes battle after the break. Oh, Mourners have left flowers and candles at the steps of the Supreme Court, and tributes have been pouring in over the weekend for the late Justice Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Ginsburg's death just weeks before the presidential election has already launched a fierce battle in Washington on how and when to fill her vacancy, a lifetime appointment that will have lasting impact on the country. Joining us now is Journal White House reporter Catherine Lucey. Hi there, Catherine.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Catherine, Justice Ginsburg said it was her dying wish that no one be nominated to replace her until after the election. But President Trump said over the weekend that he's going to put a name forward this week.
So we will uphold equal justice under the law for citizens of every race, color, religion, and creed. I will be putting forth a nominee next week. It will be a woman.
So, Catherine, if it is a woman, who is on the short list?
Yes, that's right. The president yesterday suggested he would nominate a woman and then very clearly said he will be a woman. He has issued a pretty lengthy list of potential picks, but our reporting is that there are two top contenders at the moment. They're both federal appellate judges, Amy Coney Barrett, who's from the Seventh Circuit, and Barbara Lagoa of the 11th Circuit. Obviously, the president said last night at a rally that he has not made a final choice yet, so it's possible another name could creep in there. But for now, these are considered the sort of top contenders.
Catherine, as you know from being in Washington, this is very controversial. If we look back in 2016, the Republicans refused to hold hearings for President Obama's nominee to replace Antonin Scalia because it was an election year and said they were setting a precedent. Now the tables have turned and we're much closer to the election. But Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell says Trump's nominee will receive a vote on the floor of the Senate. What's their argument for the flip-flop?
Their argument is that this is a different situation because the Republicans hold both the White House and the Senate at the moment. And they are arguing that that gives them the authority and the obligation to move forward. Obviously, Democrats are really pushing back on this. They're saying that Republicans are violating a standard they set 4 years ago. But the Judiciary Committee Chairman Lindsey Graham said over the weekend that he will preside over a hearing and was willing to proceed with this.
There is some math here, 53 Senate Republicans, so they've got the numbers, but there are some Republicans who might be on the fence. What do we know now?
That's right. The Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell could only lose three Republicans and get this through. And we have now heard from some of his members. Senator Susan Collins of Maine said over the weekend that the winner of the presidential election should choose the next nominee and that the Senate shouldn't vote until the election has happened. Senator Lisa Murkowski is also saying that she opposes filling this vacancy before the election.
Let's turn to the Democrats. On Sunday, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi told ABC's This Week that they have options.
We have arrows in our quiver that I'm not about to discuss right now.
So what arrows might they have?
Yeah, so they've been talking some about this privately. And Senator Schumer said over the weekend on a call with his members that Republicans should be careful that they will, look at all their options if Republicans move forward with a vote on this vacancy. And some of the things that have been discussed, if Democrats take back the Senate, could be, getting rid of the legislative filibuster next year or possibly expanding the Supreme Court. So these are things that they're certainly, sort of talking about or floating at this point.
What impact do you think this will have on the campaign?
Now, this potentially has a huge impact on the campaign for a number of reasons. I mean, it's a really seismic moment in what already is a very turbulent and closely fought campaign. The president is trailing his Democratic opponent, Joe Biden, in the polls and has been looking for a way to try and make up lost ground. The vacancy gives him a couple of opportunities. One is it shifts attention away from the coronavirus pandemic, which has really been defining the race to date. This also gives him an opportunity to focus attention on one of his key issues from his first term, which has been confirming conservative judges. And that's an issue that really motivates and rallies his base. And he sees this. And you saw at his rally on Saturday night in North Carolina, he had his supporters chanting, "Fill the seat," which may end up being the new "build the wall" in the final stretch of this campaign. So for Democrats, this potentially refocuses some of the conversation of the race on the stakes here. What would happen if the president was able to fill this vacancy, thus creating a, you know, a six-person conservative majority on the court? You should expect to see them really talking about issues like abortion, what could happen with rulings on healthcare, and how those things might impact Americans' lives.
And finally, the stakes are high, not just for the election.
No, that really is the point here. This isn't just about the six-week march to Election Day. These are lifetime judicial appointments. The president and Mitch McConnell have made a real focus of installing conservative judges across the board and bringing in younger judges so that these people will fill these positions for a long time. The candidates we hear the president talking about, you know, could be in this role for decades to come. And that would really solidify a conservative majority on the court. And that would change things.
Catherine Lucy joining us from Washington. Catherine, I have a feeling we'll talk again soon. Thanks for being here this morning.
Thank you. I hope so.
And finally, just a reminder, it is Monday morning. 6 months ago, that might have meant getting dressed up to go into the office. But for people working from home, casual Friday has become casual every day in many cases. Doesn't matter what you wear if no one can see your whole outfit. Our reporter Ray Smith has been talking to researchers, and some say clothes can impact productivity.
People are finding that they notice that there's a difference in how well they perform or how productive they are if they dress a little more casual or very casual compared to the way they dress to work. It's a phenomenon known as enclosed cognition.
But what about the popular Zoom attire when people dress professionally on top but slouchy on the bottom?
That's something that scientists are actually starting to look at, and whether or not, for instance, that creates a sense of making you feel inauthentic, like you're a phony or you're a fraud, or conversely, making you feel like you have this real big secret and you're sort of subversive and you're thriving on that, sort of the thrill of people on the call maybe not knowing exactly what you're wearing on the bottom.
Ray says there's another aspect of putting on nicer clothes for work. Some scientists believe changing clothes might help people turn off at the end of the day.
One psychologist called it the Mr. Rogers effect. It's where you're signaling to the brain that these are two different modes. And so that sort of helps you in terms of your attention and your focus and telling your brain what you're doing at the moment.
You can find Ray's story and some tips on how to dress up the comfy clothes at WSJ.com. And that's what's news for Monday. We're back tonight with an updated show. If you like us, please rate and review us wherever you get your podcasts. I'm Mark Stewart with The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.